rabbis give us Talmudic phrase called Mika Amcha. What kind of people is this? Which brings to mind, this is the fifth, or if you've been for Shabbat, seventh day of creation, of the moon. What are we doing here? It's crazy. I made 10 handouts. We're going to spend, I hope, just an hour, because it's the last session, and after this we're all going to go into the real world. But we're going to stay for one more minute in Gan Eden. Imagine, if you will, this is a tiered living room with a fireplace. An oak panel living room with a fireplace. Because what we're going to do here is not, this is not a lecture, this is essentially a story. We're going to tell the story of a very beloved character called Elisha ben Avuya, who many of you know, and many of us love. And what I suggest is that we read it together, and we think about it together, and I hope that it will be a fitting conclusion to your learning this week. The first thing... Are there more handouts? That's it, I think, in terms of handouts. The text will be up on the... So that's all we have. We don't have any more. Please share. By way of introduction, the word heresy comes from the Greek herestai, which means, surprisingly, to choose. Speak up a little bit, yes. There's a mic as well, but I have to stop walking. to choose. Interesting, isn't it? Because to choose is such a modern thing to do. To choose is what it means to be a modern person. We are doing this session in a university where you have all the opinions and all the approaches and all the paradigms, and you bring them together and you choose which one is more suitable for the particular subject or topic at hand. That is what it means to be a modern person. What does it mean to be a heretic? It means someone who denies the authority to be inclusive and binding on a particular topic. A person who's a heretic, if you will, is someone who picks and chooses, which is what we all do today. And that's one of the reasons why the story of Elisha ben Avuya is such a story that to such an extent resonates with us. We're going to tell a story. What I've done in compiling this story is essentially to combine two accounts, as it were, biographical sketches of the life of Elisha. And they're culled from the Yerushalmi and from the Bavli, from the Babylonian Talmud, both Masechtot Chagiga. I put it together because really we want to preserve here the narrative. Please keep in mind the crackling fire in the fireplace as we read this. I'm going to start us off, and then if I'm going to ask you to read as well, so you don't have to spend the entirety of the next hour and 10 minutes trying to place my Norwegian accent. Okay, so Rabbi Meir. Okay, this is. Imagine yourself back. Imagine yourself back in first. First or turn of the first to second century Palestine, Judea. Rabbi Meir was seated in the house of study in Tiberias on Shabbat, expounding, teaching, while his teacher Elisha was passing through the marketplace astride his horse on Shabbat. People came by and told Rabbi Meir, "Look, your teacher Elisha is here riding through the marketplace." Rabbi Meir interrupted his expounding, and went out to him. Elisha asked, "What verse have you been expounding today?" Rabbi Meir, "So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning." Elisha, "What did you say about it?" Rabbi Meir, "The Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. God doubled his possessions." Okay, two things to note just as we start off the story. What do we notice first of all? Elisha is riding through the marketplace astride his horse on Shabbat. I'm going to ask a number of rhetorical questions here and answer them myself, which is bad teaching practice. But
I think both in the interest of the fact that we have people here with hearing impairments, and this is the only mic, and we don't have a roving one, and also because I don't want this session to overrun, because I know people want to get on the road. So if you have something to add, please raise your hand and shout, and we'll do it at the clip. We noticed three things in the first paragraph. We noticed that Elisha is astride his horse riding through the marketplace. So we know that he's, as it were, left halachic Judaism. We learn something more, however. He doesn't only break Shabbat in the comfort of his own home. He rides in the marketplace on Shabbat. That is an act of, it's sort of demonstrative breaking Shabbat, which tells you something about his mood, if you will. Number two we learn is that when Rabbi Meir interrupts his teaching to go out and greet him, Rabbi Meir still considers him his teacher. He still gives him the kavod, the respect as a teacher. And the third thing we read is that he interrupts his learning. Right? Rabbi Meir feels that it's so important to see his teacher who's essentially fallen from grace, and that he interrupts his teaching, and we know how that important that is. Interesting, isn't it, that the topic that he's teaching is Job. Another story of a tortured soul trying to make sense of the divine. And read. Let's just continue one more paragraph. Elisha, alas for those who are gone and are no more. Your teacher Akiva would not have spoken thus. He would have construed these words: the Lord blessed the latter end of Job because of the beginning, because of the observance of precepts and good deeds that had been Job's at the beginning. Again, I'm going to ask a rhetorical question. What is Elisha occupied here? We know that Rabbi Meir is occupied with the book of Job, but what is Elisha's reading, essentially? Elisha, one could say, like Job, is a person whose beginning was a lot better than the middle, or perhaps even the latter part of their lives. And it's interesting that Elisha does what all of us do so often. He reads himself into the text. And he sees in Job's beginning some kind of redemptive quality. And perhaps it's a hope on his part that his early learning and early actions will be, as if it were, redemptive for him. And so he continues. Elisha says, what other verse did you expound? Rabbi Meir, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And we have this theme developing. Elisha, what did you say about it? Rabbi Meir, you have a man who acquired merchandise in his youth and sustained a loss, but in his old age makes a profit from it. Or you have a man who learned Torah in his youth and forgot it, but it comes back to him in his old age. Elisha, alas for those who are gone and are no more. Your teacher Akiva would not have spoken thus. He would have construed it, good is the end of a thing from the beginning, when it is good from its beginning. Acharit. Again, both these characters are preoccupied not so much with the text as with themselves. Comment, Rabbi Goldfarb.
Both turn on the double meaning of the mem, Mereshit.
Right. So mem
from the beginning or more than the beginning.
Right, and that is the creative genius, I think. That the mem, one letter, it can hinge on a single letter. As it does in this case. But what are we doing when... this is sort of... I have to scroll. Sorry, I'm not used to this. Okay, you've got to scroll. You've got to tell me. That's it. We got there. This is the next line.
We're
getting there. That's it. Sorry. Is that right? Do you see it?
No.
That's the next line, no? Okay. Okay. It comes back to him in his old age, sorry. Rabbi Meir, so you too must come back, right? So we had the smokes and mirrors, we had the playing with the text, we had the dikduk of the grammatical comment about the mem here and there, but they weren't really speaking to each other. But all of a sudden they sort of take off their mask, or at least Rabbi Meir does, and he says directly to his teacher, so you too must come back. Elisha, I cannot, because I've heard the divine voice reverberating. Return, O backsliding children. This is a quote from Jeremiah. Except for Elisha ben Abuya, who knew my strength and yet rebelled against me. Yes?
No, where are we?
What's the next
page? Skip to two paragraphs.
Oh.
Right. We haven't done the top two paragraphs.
Sorry. I'll read it from this one then. Good? Okay. So that's okay. That's weird.
So it happened with me.
So it happened with me. Okay. Okay, so it happened with me. We're on the same page. So it happened with me. I'm on the wrong page. And that's what also going on. Your teacher would not have spoken thus. This is the end of the previous line. He would have construed it, good is the end of a thing from its beginning, when it is good from its beginning. So it happened with me. Abuya, and this is Elisha talking. So it happened with me. Abuya, my father, was one of the notables of Jerusalem. When he was arranging for my circumcision, he invited all the notables of Jerusalem, among them Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Right, these are the great and the good of Jerusalem. After they had eaten and drunk, they began to clap their hands and dance. Some of the notables sang songs, and others composed alphabetical acrostics. Rabbi Eliezer said to Rabbi Yehoshua, "These are occupied with what interests them. Shall we not occupy ourselves with what interests us?" They began to speak words of Torah, and from the Torah to the prophets, and from the prophets to the writings, and fire came down from heaven and surrounded them. At that point, Abuya said to them, "My masters, have you come to set my house afire over me?" They replied, "God forbid, we're merely sitting and singing words of Torah." Then from the Torah went to the prophets, and from the prophets to the writings. For the words were as joyful as when they were given at Sinai. For when originally given at Sinai, they were given in the midst of fire, as it is said, "And the mountain burned with fire unto the heart of heaven." Elated, my father Abuya remarked, "My master, since the power of Torah is so great, if this child stays alive for me, I will dedicate him to the Torah. But because the intent of my father's resolve was not for the sake of heaven, Leshem Shamayim, my study of Torah did not endure with me." Scroll. Thank you. Did not endure with me. We're going to stop there for a second. What is the point made here? Why does he tell this story? I'd like to suggest that one element of depression, one element of being depressed, as it is defined clinically, is the idea that one's life, one's condition is determined, that one has no chance, that one has no option. This is part, I think, if I'm not mistaken, of Beck's triad of depression. So we feel fated, we feel determined, and that gives us a feeling of no way out. And I'd like to suggest that the mood here that Elijah describes for himself is a kind of depressed mood. He feels that already from the start he was, as it were, left with no option because of the way he started off learning, as he sees it, not for the sake of Torah itself, but for ulterior motives, to get the power, as it were, of the fire of heaven. And this is the story he tells of himself. And this is an interview. This is an injection into the story, just to give us an insight into how Elisha sees himself. We know that he's already, he was one of the great rabbis of the Akivan generation. He was probably the one as great as Rabbi Akiva, and something changed in his life, and he left it. He dropped it. He wasn't able to hold on to it. And he's profoundly dislocated, profoundly depressed, and the aim here of reading the story, one of the aims is to understand why, what happened. Now the conversation, however, continues, because if one thing is preserved in this story, it is the student-teacher relationship. If one thing remains holy, it is the act of learning and transmission. And so they revert back to their comfortable roles of teacher and student. Elisha, what other verse did you expound? Heaven may gold and glass cannot equal it, neither shall the exchange thereof be vessels of fine gold. Elisha, what did you say about it? Heaven may, these are the words of Torah. They are as difficult to acquire as vessels of gold, and are as readily destroyed as vessels of glass. Elisha by God, even as readily as earthenware vessels that break very easily. But your teacher Akiva would not have spoken thus. He would have said, as vessels of gold and even vessels of glass can be repaired if broken, so a disciple of the wise can recover their learning if it has disintegrated. So who is Elisha here speaking about? Remember, so you too must come back. And this is the paragraph that I mistakenly read before. Elisha, I cannot. He doesn't say I will not. He doesn't say I don't want to. He says I cannot. That is the depressed condition. I see no way out, even if I would want to come back. Something has broken for me, like an earthenware vessel, which is very frail. Because I've heard a divine voice reverberating, return, O backsliding children, except for Elisha. There's something just... Everyone else is fine with this. This sits well with everyone. It's just I who can't figure it out. He feels very alone here, because he has all this learning, all this strength, and he feels that he's rebelled against the order. His thoughts don't allow him to be within the fold. And now we really come to it. It's interesting, by the way, if you look at the English translation here, the rebel doesn't really cover it, because the word in Hebrew, the second word from the end in Hebrew, is marad, which really isn't rebelling. It's certainly not in modern Hebrew. It means an act of betrayal. An act of betrayal. This is God as emotional. This is God saying, Elisha betrayed me. Now we're going to go for a walk outside Tiberias. This continues. Please. Sorry?
I think betrayal is forgot.
How would you translate marad? How would you translate marad?
Marad is betrayal, like forgot. To betray.
But when it comes to a person, marad be.
It's still rebelled. Not in question.
Okay, I'll leave that hanging. When, please.
On page 2, does he not see this as a decree that is beyond his own doing, that it's his destiny?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's his destiny.
And that's why he's depressed. And that's why he says, I cannot.
Yes.
It doesn't depend on him. It depended on what his father did.
Well, that's the story he tells of his father, yes. But is that a true story? That's the story he chooses to tell himself. But is that a true story? Does it matter if it's a story? It becomes a true story in his act of believing in it. And some psychoanalysts say that it doesn't really matter what the stories are that you bring up in therapy. What matters is that they are constructive or useful. So the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves define who we are. Anyone else want to comment at this stage? Would anybody like to read? I'm aware that I'm kind of imposing on everyone, but this is, it's just the mic situation is a bit tricky. Please.
In the English.
In English, yeah. Okay, but shout.
When Rabbi Meir and Elisha had walked a long while, Elisha on his horse on Shabbat and Rabbi Meir after him, hanging on to his teacher's every word, Acher said to him, Meir, turn back, for I have just measured by the paces of my horse that the Shabbat limit extends only thus far. He replied, you too go back. Acher answered, have I not just told you that I have already heard from behind the heavenly curtain, return, O backsliding children, except Acher? Nevertheless, Rabbi Meir prevailed upon him and took him to a schoolhouse, where Acher said to a child, recite for me your verse. The child answered, there is no peace, says the Lord, unto the wicked.
Okay, hold it. Okay. Thank you. So two things just by way of clarification. Acher is the second name that we are now introduced to. Acher is the first. This is the first time the other name of Elisha ben Abuya is mentioned, and Acher means the other. Whether that's an appellation that he's earned because of his rejection, or whether it's a later attribution, we don't know. But Acher really, we're gonna come to a piece later on, which might be the first time he's called Acher. Maybe that helps us to understand it better. But what does it mean to be called the other? It bespeaks a kind of otherness, a kind of dislocation that perhaps links in with his internal emotional state. And the other thing to to notice that this we're now going to have a number of repetitive scenarios, and all of them starts with this phrase psoket psokha, and he goes into the schoolhouses. Please continue.
Rabbi Meir took him to another schoolhouse where Achel said to a child, recite for me your verse. The child answered, for though you wash yourself with nitre and use much soap, yet your iniquity is marked before me, says the Lord God. Rabbi Meir took him to yet another schoolhouse where again Achel said to a child, recite for me your verse. The child answered, and you, despoiled one, what can you do that you wear crimson, that you adorn yourself with golden ornaments, that you enlarge your eye with paint? In vain do you make yourself fair. They seek your life. And thus Rabbi Meir took Achel to 13 schools, one after another, where in like vein all the children quoted verses boding evil. When Achel said to the last child, recite for me your verse, he answered, but unto the wicked, God says, for what reason do you recount my statutes? That child had a speech defect, so it sounded as though he answered, but to Elisha, God said. At that, Elisha said, had I a knife in my hand, I would have cut him to pieces.
Yes. Thank you. Why is Rabbi Meir bringing Elisha into the schoolhouses of Judea? Why is he doing that? What might be his intention here?
To find some way of reintegrating him.
Of reintegrating him. Perfect. That's a great word. Reintegrating him. Showing him. Look at the beauty of learning. Look at how the Talmidim are engaged in profound discussions and how they're learning. Isn't it wonderful? And you, as the greatest teacher, next to Akiva, how much you can teach them, how much they will respect you and learn from you. And what does he encounter when he goes into the schoolhouses? Rejection. Okay, great. So integration and rejection. What does he encounter other than his own, as it were, prison of the mind? Whether the school children are quoting these verses as a kind of mild or perhaps not so mild rebuke, or whether this is what Elisha hears everywhere he goes, we don't know. We don't know. And it might be a bit of both.
It tells us when it says he hears it that way, it's almost like there's a paranoia here. He's seeing all these.
Okay, so we have depression and we have paranoia. Sounds familiar, right? Okay. If you want to combine them, because a depressed state is, or a paranoid, I mean, I think there's a phrase in clinical psychology, the narcissism of the paranoid personality. If you think that the whole world is out to get you, that's a fairly solipsistic worldview, right? It might be true, but it's still it's a brooding personality that he has, and an aspect of it is his depression. Another thing is that everything he hears is about him. Paul.
And it's the narcissistic rage, then the inverse of it, that makes him want to murder the child. The other wants to murder in response. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, if I can paraphrase that to say, I mean, you're a psychologist, and I'm taking what you say very seriously. From the depression to the paranoia to the passive aggressive, right? He's building up, and almost, you know, as Freud said, beware the fury of the patient man. And we see this here. He can't hold it in any longer. Please. He was one of the four rabbis who went into the Pardes, which perhaps places in him some privileged situation. But it depends what you mean with mystic, I think.
Was he a Jew that before he left?
Was he a Hasid?
Practice mysticism, because he might see this as going into 13 schools and having 13 of the same type of response. He might see this as more than coincidence.
I think it is more than coincidence. Whether it's mysticism or psychology, I don't know. Please.
Know that the free will at the end of the day is all that a person has. It's actually interesting that they're going and looking for so to say, the divine voice, where they can make their own choice, which will defeat this voice, because it's Shabbat plus the repentance is dependent on the individual of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that passiveness will accept it.
Thank you, excellent. So, from the mouth of babes, in a sense. And a counter, what did you call it? Counter prophecy. That's a great line. Thank you. There's something Kafkaesque I'd like to add to this picture of this the narcissistic, passive aggressive, paranoid personality. There's no way out, and he's sort of stuck within himself. His cognition, in a sense, is biased. The two next paragraphs are slightly different, and it zooms out, if you will, and it gives some background knowledge of Elisha, and it's essentially stories of him. And this is the Talmud that's a slapstick comedy, in a sense. It is said of him of Acher that Greek song did not cease from his mouth, and whenever he arose to leave the house of study, many heretical books would fall out of his lap. It is also said of him, of Acher, that when he entered a meeting place of scholars and saw youngsters with scrolls in front of them, he would say, "Why do these sit here and occupy themselves in this manner? This one's craft should be that of a builder. This one's that of a carpenter. That one's that of a painter. And that other one's that of a tailor." When the youngsters heard such talk, they left their scrolls and went away. Does this resonate with us today, in some sense? I'd like to not bring this into the Israeli political discourse, which is always sort of under the surface, I think, in all our discussions. I'd like to bring it into a different realm and to suggest that that Elisha, in some ways, can be seen, if you want to be just slightly flippant, as the Richard Dawkins of his day, pulling the tugging at the students, saying, "Why are you engaged in this kind of discourse?" So,
Greek song.
Okay, how are we doing? Any questions, comments, counter sermons so far? Please.
Is there another level to this? The motif of his relationship with children. I mean, the verse before they go into the schools is "Return, O backsliding children." Before that, there is this invocation of his youth as a child with a lot of Torah, and then losing it. Is it making a statement about his relationship to the youth or to his youth? Like, can you talk about this with you?
I hadn't thought of that before, that there's actually quite a lot of stories to do with youth and children here. The only thing I can think of on one foot is to say that it links in with this theme of the teacher-student relationship. But this is a text about God and about divinity, but also about learning and being and developing as a person. Did you want to add something of your own?
No, we know that, like, from the story of the Garden of Pardes, that Acher is known as the one who cut the roots, and that maybe his relationship to the lineage of the teacher-student relationship through this children that's perhaps is trying to be rectified through his student by providing him an opportunity either to be reminded of the role that he once had with his teacher, or to provide him an opportunity to teach and to rectify that role.
Right. So I think the fact that he's described as the one who cuts the shoots is interpreted, like you say, as the one who persuaded youngsters or students not to engage with Torah. Is that correct? Would you? Is that?
That's correct. And then I guess what I'm trying to connect is this: the imagery of the children and this journey into the schoolhouse as perhaps being some kind of tikkun for what we identify him as.
But he's not successful.
It's the opposite. He's always killing a child, and here he's chasing children away from their books. It's sort of presenting him still in that theme of a danger to children and to scholarship among children. It's not a redemptive process.
Maybe what
it's a failed redemption process.
All right. So maybe what you can say is that he wants to, but he fails. He wants to engage, but he's not able to.
Who initiates the walk into the school? Is that a book?
That's Mayer. Yeah, his student.
His student is trying to
save their teacher from himself. Yes, which is a great paradigm.
Maybe he's trying to lift a can from them because his father fixed his future in Toro when he was a child. And maybe he's trying to liberate them
to make their own choices.
The fate, right, from the fate that
happened. That's a great reading. Thank you. Let's continue with the story because now we really want to get to the heart. And the text asks the question directly: what did Acher see that made him go wrong? It is said that once, while sitting in the valley of Genesar, he saw a man climb to the top of a palm tree on Shabbat, take the mother bird with the young, and descend in safety. At the end of Shabbat, he saw another man climb to the top of the same palm tree and take the young but let the mother bird go free. As he descended, a snake bit him and he died. Elisha exclaims, "It is written, let the mother bird go and take only the young, that you may fare well and have a long life." Where is the well-being of this man? And where is the prolonging of his life? Some say that Elisha became a heretic when he saw a pig dragging along in its mouth the tongue of a famous sage, Rabbi Yehuda. He said to them, "This is the tongue from which pearls of purest ray used to come forth all his days. Is this the Torah? Is this its reward? There appears to be no reward and no resurrection of the dead." Immediately, Elisha, or Acher, resolved to commit sin. He went out and, seeing a prostitute, beckoned to her. She asked, "Are you not Elisha ben Abuya?" It was Shabbat. And he pulled a radish out of a furrow and gave it to her. So she said, "He is clearly Acher, another." I will not develop this theme of because I think the plain meaning of the text is that he does something which is not allowed on Shabbat, that he takes a radish out of a furrow. But I don't think it's possible post-Freud to read this without at least at some level be aware of that he might have broken several mitzvot in the same way. I'd like to suggest that the fact that the prostitute in Judea knows that this is Acher is one of the greatest, it's one of those stories that are so... It has a ring of truth to it that he must have been such a great scholar that everybody knew who he was, and it is perhaps she who then names him, and perhaps of whatever the radish and the furrow story is at the heart of that. Does anybody else want to comment on this sequence, Paul?
It's very difficult to do because we've got the Yerushalmi and the Bavli interwoven beautifully.
Uh-huh.
But there is some significance, I think, in when he's called Elisha ben Abuya and when he's called Acher.
Right.
And the Acher is when he's turned, when he's lost and there's no way back. And there are even some of the episodes that come up in Bavli and Yerushalmi. In one version, he's God says, "Come back to me, my backsliding children, unless you're Elisha ben Abuya." And another one is, "Unless you're Acher." And there's something about when you're Acher, there's really no hope for coming back. And here we have a prostitute. In this bit of the text, he's Acher, and yet the prostitute calls him still Elisha ben Abuya.
Yes, yes. Wonderful, thank you. Although she says that before, his sin, as it were. So maybe that is the act of transgression, you could say. Maybe that's when he crosses over. Or maybe that crossing over happens continuously at many levels. Yes. He beckons first. That's not the transgression. Then he exposes himself or picks the radish. And then she calls him Acher. Paul.
It's interesting. Moshe Rabbeinu uses the same language, Zutara Zuschara,
yes,
when faced with the death of Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah.
God says, "Keep quiet."
Stuck, yes.
But he didn't reach that conclusion.
He didn't reach the same conclusion. No.
Right.
So I'd like to just dwell with the end of the second to last paragraph, and to say that to ask the question really, who was the person who embraced the solution to all our troubles of the resurrection of the dead? Who was the main proponent at that time of that notion? Akiva, right. So in a sense, you could see here, Elisha is rejecting the Akivan paradigm. He's saying, that doesn't work for me. And it's interesting that our tradition has preserved that machloket, that difference. Because whilst many rabbis and a significant strand of Judaism can look at the evil and the suffering of the world and say, well, that's just because this world is the corridor to Olam Haba, there is a distinct disagreement with that. And there are other sources, other teachers who hold that it doesn't work for them. Chaim.
I think we have to look for something that's more than simply saying, rejecting that there's no reward or punishment.
Mm.
That's not what he's saying. I mean, that's just on the surface. I mean, the world is purposeless. I mean, this is very serious now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would call him, in technical terms, they would call him a dualist. Right? In other words, there's no guiding force that in any way there's no end that we're purposely pursuing in this world. So he's undermining the structure of all of Jewish life, or meaningful life,
yes,
as it has been proposed from a religious worldview.
But isn't it interesting then that his act of rejection of that purposeless, as it were, godless, I think we can say in his view, world, is an act of sin? Maybe he's just used to thinking it's a habit. Because what's the point of a sin if there's no God? Right? Okay.
Right, but that also, it seems to me that it, in some ways, it plays to the popular mind of when you decide that you're not going to be an observant Jew. So what do? You know, when you decide, you go out and you have a hamburger. You know, go to McDonald's.
Yes.
I mean, what do? You know, you do something stupid. I mean, when you think about theology and the importance, eating a McDonald's burger, you know, that's the Barim Sham Nimburu Moshe Olam, you know, this is all right? But that's what people do, and naturally. You know,
thank you.
I don't know.
Thank you.
I think that maybe Elisha is talking about, and this goes with what Chaim said, about cause and effect, and that when the Torah says that the person that does shiluch hakem gets rewarded, and then this person dies. And if you look in the psukim that were brought from Job beforehand, it talks about reshit and acharit, and the acher and acharit come together. So if he's saying the reshit, the beginning, there's no cause and effect from the beginning to the end. You don't see God rewarding in this world that person, and therefore he can't deal with that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Rabbi Akiva, who's talking about Tchiyat HaBeitim, is saying, yes, you don't see that effect in the world, because you have to see it in the afterlife of the next world.
Thank you, excellent. And to add another layer to our discourse, one of the ways in which one of the reasons why we feel close to Elisha, I think, and why he's such a beloved character despite his troubled life, is perhaps because we feel those same insufficiencies. We also look at the absence, as it were, of reward and punishment in the world, and it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. And the resurrection of the dead is not necessarily the theological comfort that can heal that. Let's take two more, and then we'll move on to the next.
He doesn't stop believing in God. I think that's a big point. Like, he's angry with God, and he can't. Because all of the things, he doesn't think he's in God, he's asking God. He's saying, God saying, everyone can think except me. And he can't deal with the fact that if there's God, why is God doing these things? And that's what hurts him. He's not an atheist. He hasn't lost his faith in God. He's angry at God for why do these things happen? He can't comprehend God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like for him worse than even what's not true. He does believe it, and he's angry. Mm-hmm. That's
and we empathize. Yes.
Well, this might not be a very popular thing to say, but
go ahead.
Anyway, I find this text, a lot of it being hearsay, and
rabbis getting semi-hysterical about this
yes.
character, because in the earlier pages it says, it is also said that. It is also said. This is hearsay. This is not fact. And I find that he's being ridiculed.
Okay.
And the stories are getting heavier and heavier and heavier.
Yes. Let me take that comment very seriously. I don't think it's an unpopular thing to say at all. I think it's an extremely acute and important observation, because in the same way as Elisha is defined by the stories he tells about himself, like we saw in the beginning with the story of his father, we who are heirs and partners in the Jewish tradition are defined by the stories we tell ourselves. And what's so fascinating is that the story of Acher is preserved in our narrative. Hearsay or not, this is the story that the rabbis tell themselves and that we tell ourselves. I don't know if there are any other traditions that would include in their, as it were, pantheon a story like this.
Memorialize him.
And he's not rejected. The halachot of Elisha ben Avoya before his transgression are respected. And Rabbi Meir, who is Rabbi Meir in the Talmud? The Talmud says that every proclamation or every halakha that doesn't have a name attached to it are the proclamations, as it were, of Rabbi Meir. He is the central, he's perhaps the central character, central rabbi of the Talmud. And he is the disciple of the bad apple of Acher, of the transgressor, of the one who went to the other side. But he's not tainted by it. That's a fascinating paradigm. Would anybody like to read the next two paragraphs? Just scroll down. Sorry. Okay. Any volunteers? I'm happy to read. Andrew, you've got a big voice.
Sometime later?
Loud voice.
From sometime later?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Sometime later, Elisha ben Abuya fell ill, and Rabbi Meir was told, "Your master is ill." He went to visit him and said, "Repent." Elisha asked, "Having gone so far, will I be accepted?" Rabbi Meir replied, "Is it not written, you allow a person to return up to their being crushed? Up to the time that life is being crushed out of them?" In that instant, Elisha ben Abuya began to weep, and then he died. Rabbi Meir rejoiced, saying, "My master, it would appear, departed in a state of repentance." However, after he was buried, fire came forth from heaven to burn his grave. They went and told Rabbi Meir, "The grave of your master is on fire." Rabbi Meir went out, spread his cloak over the grave, and said to him, "Stay this night in this world which is holy night, and it shall be in the morning, the world to come, all of which is morning. If the one who is good will redeem you," that is the Holy One who is good, of whom it is said, "The Lord is good to all, and God's mercies are on all God's works. But if God is not willing to redeem you, then I, Meir, will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning." The fire was then extinguished.
Thank you. This is a remarkable ending. This is a remarkable ending to our story. What is Rabbi Meir doing here? What is Rabbi Meir doing here? He's doing many things at the same time. And one of the things that he's doing is arguing with God. What is he doing in the relation? So that's his relationship to God. What is he doing in relation to his teacher?
Till
the very end. And more than, what is that loyalty? How does it express itself? What does he do?
He redeems him.
He saves him. He redeems him. He puts himself. This is Rabbi Meir, the greatest teacher in the Talmud. Is it conceivable that his teachings would have been rejected because of this act? Yes. Could he have? Is he putting himself and his reputation at risk here? Yes, but for what? For what? What's keeping him in? What's causing him to do that? To risk everything?
Well, it's his love and respect of his tutor.
It's his love. It's the love and respect of his tutor and his friend. Right. That becomes redemptive now.
also the fact that he repented.
Sorry?
So he repents at the end of the
It's possible that he did repent. Or it's possible that his student really, really wanted him to repent. Yes. We don't know. I mean, that's open. Any further comments?
Do we know anybody who was rejected because he behaved in this fair way?
I was going to say, well, they have been written out. So we don't know. But what's interesting is that this rejection is written in. Not perhaps preserved, but we all know, I think it's the common narrative of rejection, and then in several places we have the phrase to be cut off. If you do certain things, you will be cut off. If you eat bread on Pesach, you will be cut off. What does it mean to be cut off? I think it exists, but not preserved in this way, because I think the preservation of this story has a particular purpose.
If you save one soul, you save the world, and you're saving the world.
Who is?
I'm Mayor.
Mayor. In what sense?
By saving the soul of his teacher.
So the act of loyalty and of love saves his teacher and thereby everything that he represents, the world, into him. Thank you. Please.
There's a symmetry with the heavenly fire at his birth. He's a baby, and then at his death.
Yes, thank you. Excellent, excellent. Please.
What was this text remind me is and you put a line under, is the action and the reward, and on all that you were already heard comments that it is not in this world, it's in another world, but maybe this concept was not developed at the time. And I know that after the Holocaust, many people actually have left, I mean, many religious Jews had this question of how can God allow this, what we see in our eyes, to happen, and they left because of the same thing. So it is very tied together to a reward in this world, which I don't know when this concept, I mean, the concept of reward in life to come, I don't know when this started.
Well, this is the infancy. This is where it develops. It doesn't exist in the Bible, like you say, it's a rabbinic idea. And it is most closely associated with Rabbi Akiva, and it's this generation, this is the debate they're having. And the second thing that you mentioned, which is so crucial, because if not spoken of, it's there as well underneath the surface, is that exactly this is post-Holocaust theology in the first century and in our century, and it feeds into this debate.
How do we relate that to the comment in the previous page about there appears to be no reward and no resurrection of the dead? Anything specific about Gethsemane that he's concerned about, and in what context what role does that play in this?
Are you pointing out that the text is slightly inconsistent? That the solution is... Yeah. I think that
no,
doesn't...
What do you mean? What are you suggesting, sir?
I'm suggesting that you're suggesting that there's an inconsistency. If you don't believe in the resurrection of the dead, what's the point of being saved to Olam Haba? Is that what the thrust of your comment is?
I think you answered my question.
Yes, it's inconsistent. Yes, it's wonderfully inconsistent. Yes, that's I think part of in addition to the depressive personality and the passive aggressive paranoid personality, there's also schizophrenic personality here, of holding different things at mutually exclusive things in mind at the same time.
In relation to that,
please.
Could this not be why the text was preserved? Because the text is coming. This final story is coming to say, Rabbi Akiva is right. And the death and what happens to Elisha ben Avuya after his death is what proves that Rabbi Akiva was right.
That's nice, isn't it? That's generous, because they could have just said that. Well, they could have said that his merits were not sufficient, but his teaching somehow redeems him. His relationship with his students redeems him.
In the Akivan paradigm, the point is that whatever redeems him, he is redeemed, and this is proof that in the end, Rabbi Akiva was the one who was correct.
That's one reading. I think another reading, which is equally valid, would be to say he's redeemed because we tell his story. His afterlife somehow has meaning as well, because he's not been forgotten. But yeah, there are many readings here. What I'm going to do, I think, is to take three more hands, and then I'm going to wrap up, because I want to end at 5:30 so that we feel that we ended on a high and didn't stay longer. Please. Daniel.
In the end, Rabbi Meir makes Elisha ben Avuya's interpretation of the verse correct from the beginning. because he was such a good teacher and he gave it to Rabbi Meir. That Rabbi Meir means that he is saved by the fact that he was a teacher at the beginning. What came afterwards was less important.
So the teacher role which remains
right
to the end, after the end,
and that's it. Is
redemptive.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You
David.
Mentioned that this is almost a post-Holocaust reading in the first century, but I guess the Jews of that time went through something very similar in terms of the destruction of the temple, the Bar Kokhba revolt, and so maybe this is also a question that many Jews at the time also had. How could God allow these things to happen?
Absolutely.
So maybe that's part of the purpose of this whole story.
Well, and I think we're mindful of that in the story of the tongue of Rabbi Yehuda that we read about, which is part of our liturgy now. We read the story of the martyrs, the 10 martyrs, and it's just part of this. I think that's in the post-temple Hadrianic persecutions, but it's exactly that. It is the insecurity and the doubt and the fear that pervades that century as it goes now, ours. Two more hands and then we'll conclude. David.
Could this idea, the fact that it's been preserved, link in with Rabbi Meir at the beginning teaching the Book of Iyov? Because in the Book of Iyov, there is, the whole purpose of Iyov, one might suggest, is to recognize that people do have responses to suffering that perhaps are not halakhically correct, but are human. And that what's happening here is that Acher is having one response to what's happened, what he's seen, as the gentleman said about, with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. What the Gemara is saying is these are human responses, but when you have them, it's not totally destructive to you.
Right. And you don't leave, even though you
feel. That's right. You're not excluded just because you have what is a human response.
Yes. Great. One more comment on that.
More than that, it's exactly what he's been teaching Meir right at the beginning. He says, the Lord will bless you because of your beginning. And he was brought up right at the beginning of his life. And that's the very first thing he repeats to Meir right at the beginning of this whole section.
You mean that?
So it's Meir's listening to him and trying to redeem him because of his teaching.
Yes. And that's what remains. Chaim, and then we'll continue.
I just want to comment on, I just looked and saw that you defined heresy. So Peter Berger has a very famous introduction, title of the book actually, that's not problem, my problem. But anyway, what he says, that since heresy means to choose, then anyone in modernity is a heretic. And that's an important dimension of our consciousness as religious people.
Yes.
That we live as religious heretics in our lives. That,
right.
To the extent that we're aware of the fact that we make a choice, I think and the Gemara sort of introduces us to this type, to this lifestyle.
2,000 years prior, yes.
And I would recommend that people take a look at what's his name's book, at the As It Really Is.
Right. So
it's a marvelous play.
It's a fiction. Many of you know this book, As a Driven Leaf, Milton Steinberg. It's a sort of a fictional history, or in inferred history of but historical in a sense. And the second book that Rabbi Chaim mentioned is The Heretical Imperative, with the thrust of what I mentioned at the beginning about what it means to be modern. Really, Peter Berger says it even stronger. He says there's an imperative to choose in the modern condition. We have to, as it were, in a sense, be heretical. I'd like to spend the last 2 minutes in detailed to look very closely, to zoom in, as it were, on this final paragraph, because it's a startling and beautiful comparison. Somebody's leaning against the light on the back.
Zooming in.
All right, we're zooming in. Okay, so I've written this out, and I'd like to read it to you. Because it's so important to get it right, and it's not it's actually a complex comparison, he does a lot of theological work under the surface. And I'd like to unpack it with you. Okay, so it goes like this. Finally, how are we to understand the story of Elisha ben Abuya? In an act of tenderness, ingenuity, of love, Rabbi Meir, the devoted student, the loyal friend, refuses to allow his teacher to be rejected. In the act of combining the fate of Elisha with that of Ruth, Rabbi Meir performs perhaps the greatest exegetical hat-trick in history. But what is happening here? Rabbi Meir casts Elisha in the role of Ruth. Who was Ruth? Ruth was the Moabite, a Moabia, a people that the Bible itself declares shall never enter the congregation of Israel. That's in Deuteronomy. Shall never enter. These were, as it were, others, foreigners, strangers, transgressors. Like Elisha, however, Ruth is powerful, yet suspect. And like Acher, she triumphs. And Ruth marries into the Davidic line of Boaz, who is the descendant of Yehuda and Tamar, and thereby enters the royal line. Through an act of choice, and we mentioned at the beginning the importance of choice and the heretical nature of choice. From Ruth's point of view, what she did when she converted to Judaism must have been perceived as heresy. Through an act of choice, a heretical act of commitment, she actually also performs at the same time an act of fidelity. She says, what's Ruth's most famous line? Amechami Elokai Elokai. Your people shall be my people. Your God shall be my God. Like Acher, Ruth signifies both opportunity on the one hand and threat. Her choice remarks the Israelites as a chosen people, as a people worthy of being chosen. By incorporating the otherness of Ruth, the regime is secure. She's always referred to as Ruth HaMoaviah, Ruth the Other, yet it is her loyalty, her act of choosing, that defines her. And we celebrate that act of choosing. Yet note, if Elisha is cast in the role of Ruth, then Meir, who redeems him, casts himself in the role of Boaz. And God is cast in the nameless role of the brother of Elimelech, who famously doesn't show up. In the Jewish tradition, this nameless person has been given a sobriquet, a nickname, Tov, since the text says, Imegalech Tov Yigal, the nameless, faceless, anonymous, silent, absent. Tov, who doesn't show up, is good. And from the final line, we understand that it worked. It persuaded God. The end of heavenly fire signals divine acceptance. Just as the rabbinic tradition embraced Ruth, so the Jewish people, culturally and historically, has embraced Elisha ben Abuya. His teachings are adhered to, and his devoted disciple Rabbi Meir's name remains untainted. The Jewish people carries this otherness within it. It integrates it, in the shape of Ruth as in the shape of Acher. What does this mean? In Julia Kristeva's phrase, we're harboring the constant quest for welcoming and going beyond the other in ourselves. The sovereign David is also a Moabite. In the Jewish embrace of God lies the Jewish embrace of the border crossing, the transgressive, the forbidden other. End quote. So in the end, the story speaks of our own otherness, the Acher that resides within us all. And its message is this. It's okay. You're fine. All those worries and doubts you harbor, they're part of the story too. Thank you.